You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric. On tonight's program, Josh talks with Sean Carroll about his latest book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. The most trusted explainer of the most mind-boggling concepts pulls back the veil of mystery that has too long cloaked the most valuable building blocks of modern science. This book is an inspiring, dazzling introduction to a way of seeing that will resonate across cultural and generational boundaries for many years to come.
And I'm Dave, and I would like to personally welcome Eric on behalf of the Right On Radio team and everyone at KFAI. Woo! This is his debut performance. Nice job, Eric. And in the last part of this show, in the last part of the hour, we will be featuring one of our legacy interviews. Tune in as we do a deep dive into the archives and play an interview from the past. You won't want to miss that. All this and more. So stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Most pop science physics books explore the topics in the field on a superficial level, giving the reader the impression the authors don't trust that the readers are willing to roll up their sleeves and think through equations. On the other hand, there's countless lengthy tomes that teach physics but can be intimidating, dry, and highly complex. Sean Carroll's new book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, the first in a three-book series, discusses how space and time come together to form space-time, why calculus is fundamental to everything we understand about the universe, what escapes from black holes, and so on. Sean Carroll is the Homewood Professor of Natural Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. His research focuses on fundamental issues in quantum mechanics, gravitation, statistical mechanics, and cosmology. He has wide-ranging interests, including philosophy, complexity theory, and information. Sean Carroll, welcome back to Right On Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Before we get into your book, I wanted to ask about your title, the Homewood Professor of Natural Philosophy. Natural philosophy isn't a term you hear too often today referring to modern physics. Why did you decide to go with this designation?
Well, the first thing that happened was I became very interested in a certain kind of philosophy. I've been a physicist my whole adult life, and I always had background interest in philosophy as well as other things. But what I learned over time is that there's this little subset of philosophers who are really just doing physics, but they're doing it in a way that would never get them hired in a physics department, right? So they become philosophy professors. They're asking about the fundamental nature of time or quantum mechanics or whatever. And I really, really sympathized with that kind of analysis. And it's been a direction that I've been doing research in myself. The other thing is, you know, in accord with that, my own research projects have been changing, and I became less and less of a comfortable fit in a conventional physics department. And Johns Hopkins basically made a job for me where I can do exactly what I want to do. And I sort of have an office in the physics department and an office in the philosophy department. And best of all, I got to pick my own title. So I said, you know, half jokingly, can I call myself a professor of natural philosophy like Isaac Newton would have done? And they were all in favor of it. They're like, yes, that's great. Let's do it.
Yeah, I read that on your blog. So yeah, you mingle between the philosophy departments and physics departments at Johns Hopkins. And you're teaching two classes this semester, one physics of democracy and an upper level course called philosophy of physics. Amazing courses. I'm jealous of those students who get to have those. What are the topics you're discussing in those classes?
So the physics of democracy is actually a physics course, not a philosophy course. And what we're doing is applying ideas from physics to think about democratic societies and voting and things like that. So a lot of it is basically the study of complexity combined with the study of voting and democratic decision making. So how do you get emergent behavior from individual behavior. This is a very common theme from physics all the way up to economics, right? Like Adam Smith famously tried to understand how the market could reach a sensible price for things, not because of any central planner, but because of people doing their individual behaviors. And to me, democracy is the classic example of that, where you have a whole bunch of people, they vote, they do their individual thing, and the country comes to some conclusion because of that. But I don't think that people have really done the interesting work of directly applying physics ideas to that situation. So that's what we're trying to do. The other class on topics in the philosophy of physics is just a grab bag of my favorite questions in philosophy of physics, foundations of physics, really. So we talk about the arrow of time, we talk about quantum mechanics and the measurement problem, and we talk about the multiverse and the anthropic principle. And, you know, they're just some of the biggest, most fun ideas out there. So yeah, I think the class is enjoying that one.
Some of those we'll get into a bit later in this discussion, but I want to talk about your book now. Let's talk about the biggest ideas in the universe. What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, sadly, we had a pandemic. And so when the pandemic hit, and like many people, you know, I thought like, what can I do? I'm pretty useless. I'm a theoretical physicist. I'm not going to cure COVID or build a vaccine or whatever, but maybe I can help keep people entertained. So I was inspired by a friend of mine, Lauren Gunderson, who is a playwright, who started giving playwriting lessons on Facebook and said, I can do that. I can teach people physics on YouTube. So I made a series of videos. And what I realized along the way is that the thing that I can add, because there's plenty of resources out there for learning physics, either as a professional or as an amateur, but there is sort of this dichotomy. Are you a professional or are you an amateur? If you're a professional, they assume you're going to take years of physics courses as a student, and you're going to do the homework sets and the final exams and so forth, and you're going to learn all the math. If you're not a professional, then they assume that you're scared of math. You can't use it. Stephen Hawking famously said, every equation you put in your book cuts your sales in half. But I don't think that that's right. And so what I thought was that we could teach the equations as long as we didn't worry about homework problems, as long as we didn't assume you were going to grow up to be a professional physicist and spend your life solving equations, we could just teach the ideas. We could teach you what the equations mean. And you could really understand the laws of physics at a much more deep, rigorous, fulfilling level than you get from most other physics books.
You know in your book how physics seems hard for a lot of people when it's actually quite easy compared to a lot of other sciences. I want you to unpack and talk about that for a second.
Yeah, I mean, this is a point that Richard Feynman made and many other people have made. Physics is hard because physics is easy. What we mean by that is physics has this wonderful ability to take a complicated system and simplify it down to the point where you can really understand it, get an answer to that simple system, and then add in the complications later. The classic example of this is Galileo thinking about how objects fall under the force of gravity. Because, you know, Aristotle would have told you that a heavy object falls faster than a lighter one. And that's empirically true. If you drop a hammer and a feather, the hammer will fall faster. But Galileo's genius was to say, that's not because of gravity. That's because of air resistance. The air resistance is a complication that is slowing down the feather. And in fact, he said, if it weren't for air resistance, the feather and the hammer would fall at the same rate. I'm picking those two things as an example because famously, the Apollo 15 astronauts actually did this experiment. They went outside the lunar module and dropped a hammer and a feather, and you see them fall at the same rate. But in Galileo's time, what gave him the right to say, let's ignore air resistance? We weren't able to go to the moon back then, right? I mean, why was he able to simplify the problem so severely and still yet get an interesting answer? And it's a feature of physics that the way we make progress is to simplify down to the essence and add the complications back in later. That's a method that might not work in biology or in economics or whatever, but in physics, it really gets us very far. And it gets us so far that what we learn seems very intimidating and alien, whether it's quantum mechanics or relativity or whatever. So physics ends up seeming hard because it's so simple we can actually make progress.
As an educator, what have you found to be a crucial concept in physics that people will struggle to understand unless they understand the equations behind the concept?
Oh, you know, that's a great question, but there's just almost because there's too many answers. Let me give you two quick answers that are sort of at different ends of the spectrum. One is conservation of energy. Okay, this is a pretty basic thing. I think people can understand it even without the equations. But when you see the expression for the potential energy, let's say, of a ball rolling down a hill, and also the kinetic energy of a ball rolling down a hill, and then you see them trade off against each other. At the bottom of the hill, it's all kinetic energy because the ball's rolling very quickly. At the top of the hill, the ball might be moving slowly, but it's all potential energy. And that fact that energy is conserved takes on a new richness and depth if you can see it at work in the equations. At the other end of the familiarity spectrum, there's the very idea of black holes, which is my favorite example, because when Albert Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity in 1915, he wrote down an equation that he himself thought was so hard to solve, nobody would ever do it. And then a mere 2 years later, Karl Schwarzschild, who was a part-time soldier in the German army in World War I, in his spare time, learned general relativity and solved Einstein's equation. And Einstein was very impressed by this. He thought that was a great job. And implicit in that solution that Schwarzschild found was the idea of a black hole. But it was so alien and so weird that neither Schwarzschild nor Einstein nor any of their contemporaries really understood what was going on. It wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that physicists really appreciated that general relativity was predicting the existence of black holes. But as I like to say, the equations are much smarter than we are. The equations knew these things were there. It took us human beings decades to figure it out.
I think I read somewhere that Neil deGrasse Tyson thought that Isaac Newton was the smartest person to ever walk the face of the earth. After reading through your section on classical mechanics, I was curious if you had a similar thought, or did you agree with him?
I have no idea who the smartest person ever to walk the face of the earth was. How do we know it was not, you know, some person in what we now call New Mexico, you know, 300 years ago, that we don't know what they did, right? There's just no way of knowing. I will agree that Isaac Newton was the most accomplished physicist of all time, probably the most accomplished scientist. I mean, not only did he invent classical mechanics, which is really the paradigm for all of physics in subsequent generations, he also did the quantitative understanding of the law of gravity, right? The inverse square law that explains motions in the solar system. Still what we use to get a rocket to the moon, still Newtonian equations. And he invented the mathematics for it. He invented calculus. Leibniz also invented calculus after Newton did and independently. But Newton developed both the science and the calculus at the same time, which is just something that a modern scientist would have a lot of trouble doing. So I have no trouble. I mean, in fact, let me back up. Albert Einstein, who maybe has, you know, good claim to being the second most accomplished physicist of all time, he wasn't even especially good at math. He was better than you or I, but by physics standards or by mathematician standards, it was a struggle for him. He was a much more insightful and intuitive physicist than anybody else alive. But whenever he had to learn new math, he had to have someone teach it to him. When Newton had to learn new math, he invented it. and that's the difference between them.
So I want to go a little further into this. So how did Isaac Newton, Gottfried Leibniz, how did they resolve the issue in physics of breaking down time into its smallest possible units?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question. I will admit right off the bat, I don't know how they actually did it. It's a little bit of a mystery because back in those days, in the 1600s, people weren't very forthcoming about their works in progress. And in fact, I do tell the story in the book about how we finally got Isaac Newton to admit to us what he had done, because it was an amazing time. I mean, there were ideas all over the place. It was the dawn of the Age of Reason, right? The Royal Society of London had just been put together. The idea of the coffee shop where the great brains would come together and talk about big ideas was the new fad at the time. And a bunch of people in London, in the UK, pretty famous names like Robert Hooke of Hooke's Law, Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet, Christopher Wren, who designed St. Paul's Cathedral. Like, they had a lot of the ideas and they would talk to each other and they were like, yes, gravity, inverse square law, ellipses, the whole bit. But none of them had the mathematical chops to really put it together. And they knew that the smart mathematician around was Isaac Newton, but he was up in Cambridge and he was kind of a loner, you know, a kind of almost a hermit. And they finally nudged Halley, who was the youngest and most impressionable, to go up and visit Newton and say, like, could you do this calculation for us? And Newton says, oh, yeah, I've already done it. And he's like, well, could you tell us about it? Could you tell us and, you know, spread the word? And eventually they got him to write his masterful book, the Principia Mathematica, where he lays out calculus and motion and the solar system and the whole bit. But he was afraid to use calculus in that book. So it was so new and so dramatic and so weird at the time that he thought people wouldn't believe him. So he hid a lot of his reasoning behind other kinds of ways of talking about it. So honestly, I don't know what was going through Newton's mind when he invented calculus.
There's a methodological principle you bring with a book when you discuss conservation laws that I wasn't familiar with, the spherical cow philosophy. What is it, and what does this principle illustrate?
Well, it comes from a bad joke the physicists like to tell about themselves, of this poor dairy farmer who wanted to improve his dairy production. So he went to the local university and looked for a scientist and was unfortunate enough to bump into a physicist, a theoretical physicist. And he said, how do I improve my dairy production of my farm? And the physicist goes off, does some calculations, and comes back and says, well, first, assume a spherical cow. And the idea of the joke is that wouldn't really work. Cows are not spherical, and there aren't any cows that are anywhere close to spherical. If so, they're not going to be producing a lot of milk. But it's an idea that in physics, it does work. The idea is take this messy real world situation and idealize it as something which we can analyze perfectly. It's exactly what Galileo was doing with air resistance. He did it with many other kinds of systems. And so the idea in physics that you can simplify down to a system that is almost too good to be true and understand that system perfectly, the spherical cow or the toy model or whatever you want to call it. And then you add back in the complications. So you say that, you know, the favorite example system that physicists always point to is called the simple harmonic oscillator, a ball on a spring just rocking back and forth, or a pendulum rocking back and forth. This turns out to be a perfectly analyzable system and one that appears approximately all over the place, from real world pendulums or wristwatches or whatever to the vibrating quantum fields in the Standard Model of Particle Physics. This spherical cow called the simple harmonic oscillator appears over and over and over again. And I don't think you have exactly that kind of paradigm in other sciences, because in, you know, the human body, if you say, okay, I'm going to explain to you how the lungs work, but I'm going to imagine there's no such thing as the mouth or the heart or the brain or anything like that, you're not going to get very far. All these things are interconnected in a very, very central way. But in physics, you can sort of pick those connections apart and put them together later, which is why we're able to make such great progress.
I wasn't familiar with a framework you discuss in chapter 2 called the Laplacian paradigm. How do physicists use this paradigm for understanding how things change?
So Pierre-Simon Laplace was a French mathematician and physicist around the year 1800. And the way that I think about it is, even though Isaac Newton gave us Newtonian mechanics in the late 1600s, it really wasn't until Laplace that we understood the implications of Newtonian mechanics in our bones. And what I mean by that is, it was Laplace who pointed out the very basic idea that if you knew, according to the rules of Newtonian mechanics, the position and the velocity of every particle of matter in the universe, and you knew Newton's laws, and you had infinite calculational capacity. So he described it as a vast intellect that knows everything about the universe and has infinite calculational ability. Then you would be able to predict exactly what happens at every moment into the future and at every moment into the past. You can also go backwards. This idea was later called Laplace's demon, even though he didn't call it a demon. So what I call the Laplacian paradigm is just this idea that the way we think about the progress of the universe is from moment to moment. So in other words, if I know the universe now, I can predict what it will be 1 second from now. I don't need to separately know what happened before now. there is what I call conservation of information. All the information you need to know to predict the entire history of the universe is there at every moment and is preserved from moment to moment. That's the Laplacian paradigm.
One chapter I really enjoyed going through was space. You give a definition for space that changed how I think about it, the collection of all possible locations of things. Can you talk about the history of thought defining space as being either a substance or relational?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the times in the book that I indulge myself a little bit with some philosophical talk, because we didn't know what space was back then in the 1600s when Newton and Leibniz and all those folks were debating what physics should be. You know, it was all unsettled. It was all cutting edge stuff. So there was one idea that space is kind of a container, right? That when we look around and we see, oh, in my room right now, I have some books and I have a desk in front of me and a coffee mug, and they're located in space. So the container idea is that space exists over and above the books and the desk and the coffee mug. And then those things have a location within space. The relational idea says, roughly speaking, there isn't any such thing as space. All there is the mug and the desk and the books. And there is a relationship between them, which we summarize by acting as if there's something called space. That what space really is just the sum total of all of the distances between all of the objects in the universe. And so Leibniz, for one person, actually thought that that was the way to go. And Newton kind of won that battle, and Einstein's point of view sort of emphasized and reinforced Newton's perspective. But honestly, we don't know the final answer. There are modern theories of quantum mechanics that say that maybe the relational point of view will ultimately win out.
I'll ask you this. Time, as you explain in the book, is essential to our universe. Without time, we wouldn't have motion, evolution, and change. A crucial part of the conceptual toolkit for modern physicists is the space-time diagram. What is the space-time diagram, and how is it useful?
You know, it follows from this idea that sort of crept up on us between the 19th and 20th century, that space-time, the combination of space and time, is kind of like space. So when you want to locate something in the universe, you might say where it is. But if you want to locate an event, if you want to say, I want to meet you for dinner, you better tell me where in space and also when, right? Where in time. So there's some kind of analogy between space and time right there. And I can just draw that on a picture. You know, I can draw a picture of space and I can put coordinates on like the flat plane in front of me. I can say, here's the x-axis, here's the y-axis, and I can tell you how to locate an object by giving you its locations along the x and y axes. If you live in a city that has a grid structure, then you can just say, you know, the cross streets that locate any particular intersection. It's the same kind of idea. So on a space-time diagram, you're doing the same thing, but instead of plotting x versus y, you're plotting time versus space. So you have time going vertically, usually in these diagrams, space going horizontally, and you're admitting that we persist over time. So that rather than saying I exist at one point in space, you're saying that at different moments in time, I might exist at different moments of space. And you trace out what is called a world line, describing your whole history in the universe.
Not all physicists agree on how to define time. Can you talk about the different philosophical positions of viewing time?
Well, you're right that we don't agree on how to define it. And I think that we overemphasize how mysterious it is. I would say that there are aspects and features of time that we don't understand very well, but I don't think it's very mysterious what it is. It's a part of space-time. It's how we tell you what moment of time in the universe you are. It's part of how we locate yourself in the universe. It's exactly like space in that way. You know, it has different features of space, but it's the same kind of thing. So I don't think it's okay to think about time as any more mysterious than we think about space. If you think that space is mysterious, then you're in trouble. But, you know, time is the same kind of thing. The major difference is that time has a direction in a way that space does not. If we were out there in our spacesuits flying far away in the vacuum of outer space, there'd be no difference between up, down, left, right, forward, backward. All the directions of space would appear the same to us. But there's obviously a direction to time. There's a difference between the past and the future. And so explaining that is a big task of physics. And we were part of the way there, but there's still some aspects we need to firm up.
I'm going to ask you about that. You were talking about briefly, there is still a dispute about how to look at the general laws of physics. People are either following the camp of being humans or anti-humans. I was curious if you could talk about that for a bit and where you see yourself on that spectrum.
I can tell you might have some philosophical inclinations because you're picking out all the times in the book that I did indulge myself with the philosophy there. So, which is great because I do want to let people know that these ideas aren't settled yet, even though the ideas I talk about in this book are the true ones, the ones that will still be used 1,000 years from now. That doesn't mean that we can predict how they will fit into a better understanding going forward. So the idea of humanism versus anti-humanism is the question of how do we conceive of what the laws of physics are? And it's very similar to the question of relationalism versus substantivalism for space, right? A substantivalist says that space is a thing and that objects have a location within it. A relationalist says space is just a convenient way of summarizing everything we know about the distances between things. Likewise, for the laws of physics, an anti-Humean says laws of physics are real things. They have some oomph, some power. They generate motion in the universe from one moment to another. They have some generative force. Whereas a Humean says, no, what exists is just the universe. It's just the collection of all things that happen. And the laws are just convenient ways of summarizing that collection of things that happen. So we notice that there are patterns in what happens. Certain things happen and certain things don't. And we call those the laws of physics. I'm more on the Humean side of this debate. I tend to think that what exists is the real world and that laws of physics are convenient ways of talking about it. But I absolutely don't think that that particular debate is completely settled.
What chapter was the most difficult for you to pull together in writing this book?
I think that no one will be surprised that's a sort of a tie between chapter 7 and chapter 8, where I discuss non-Euclidean geometry and then general relativity. This is, you know, to pick up the book at all is a bit of an act of faith because there are a lot of equations in it. But what you pretty quickly realize is the equations aren't that bad. You know, you've been lied to your whole life. These equations are easier to understand than you think. But then when we get to non-Euclidean geometry, you're like, oh, no, wait, maybe it is kind of hard to understand. It's a different level of abstraction. And I do think that they're absolutely readable and understandable. I wouldn't have written the book otherwise. But they're discussing ideas that are pretty far away from our everyday experience. It's not that the ideas are intrinsically harder. It's just that our intuition hasn't equipped us with the ability to readily grasp them. So I tried very, very hard to make these ideas palatable and as quickly and painlessly as possible. And I think that it works quite well as long as you're willing to put up with it, as long as you're willing to go along for the ride. And the payoff of doing that is enormous.
And my last question for you, Sean, I mentioned earlier that this book was the first part in a trilogy. What are the next two books in the series and when do you expect they will be available for purchase?
So book two will be called Quanta and Fields, and we'll talk about quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, particle physics, the best current understanding we have of the fundamental laws of nature. And book three will be on complexity and emergence. So that's the non-fundamental laws of nature, the emergent laws that we have when many, many moving parts come together to make a complex system, whether it's the universe or a box of gas. We'll dig further into entropy and thermodynamics and information theory and things like that, but also into how complex systems are different than simple ones and how you get scaling laws and hierarchical behavior and things like that. If all goes well, they will all appear at each fall. So the next book will appear in fall 2023, the book after that in fall 2024.
I'll be looking forward to both of those coming out. This has been my time talking with Sean Carroll about his book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion. Sean, thanks so much for being here on Right on Radio.
Thanks very much for having me, Josh.
Now this.
this is from a section about the story of Charlie Africa Kunang, who was killed by police on March 1, 2015. Open your eyes. Darkness. A luxury afforded the man who owns two tents, one popped right inside the other. No streetlight filtering in. No headlights rising along tent walls. Just dark. You could be anywhere. Your father's house. Before dawn in Cameroon. Paris. Or pretend it's Berlin. You know it's America. Stretch. You want to run the canyon, your long legs striding up the ridge, out of the haze, until you reach the great vista, L.A., the city beneath you. You'll close your eyes and feel the sun on your skin, and in your mind a movie will roll, the film of all that is yet to come. You've always been gifted like this, granted stories and the power to believe them. Merci, you think. Merci, Dieu. Thank you, God. Open your eyes. March 1, 2015. Sunday. You need to call her, your sister, Lean, the other half of who you are. Bonne nuit, you texted her last night. Every day you text her. I'll call you tomorrow, mon coeur, my heart, my dear. Darkness. Silence. Earplugs. You don't hear the street begin to breathe. The tent people and the blanket people, the single room occupancy people coming out for prayer and breakfast at the missions. To stay awake all night dancing in place for 24 hours, tweaking people. The flat-out, face-down sidewalk people, the corner men who pissed the foot of the two-story glass cross they drew you to pitch your tents on this corner. Sunday. Skid Row, Los Angeles, America. This is where you are. On a mattress in a tent on the sidewalk. You flick on your flashlight. Taped to the tent's walls are photographs of Africa you got from magazines and a picture of Beyonce. Isn't that a woman? Stretch. You're going nowhere today. But your body remains strong, muscle at the shoulder, tapered at the waist. A 43-year-old man still elegantly drawn. Tall, beautiful black king, says your friend Moonchild. Some days, you actually feel like one, when the chemistry is right. Crystal raising you up, spice shifting you sideways, when you feel like you can vision your way home, across the ocean, right through the front door of your father's house in Douala. Zip open the tents, smell the street. Zoom into the right now, right here, crouching on your milk crate in front of the tents and staring down at the sidewalk. You sweep and sweep until you break the broom. And then how can you keep it clean? Tall, beautiful black king. Not this morning. So you take up the play. Macbeth, you've been studying, learning lines, reading them aloud. Come, ceiling night. The street throbbing, gospel booming from Miss Mika's corner store, radios rolling by in wheelchairs. I can't read this on the radio. So many ancient songs, Public Enemy, N.W.A., and older music. Music from the listeners' last good days, the Dramatics, Marvin Gaye, voices that balloon into the evening. The police and the mission workers and the drive-bys, snapping pictures from automobile windows. Think Skid Row gets worse at night, but they're wrong. It gets better. The cool air tamps down the fumes, the tents rise. You read out loud. Loud. Maybe it's the chemistry. End of the month, money dried up. Everybody stashed, dwindling or gone, no spice left to contain you, just the crystal rising in your gorge. I have almost forgot the taste of fears. He read at certain times, your friend Juju Pajuzu will say, willing himself sober so he can tell your story. Crash on the couch at the back of Miss Mika's store, sweating even in the after-midnight chill. He'd start around 7, reach straight through to 9:30. Not always out loud, but that Saturday night. Am I disturbing you? You ask Juju, his tent next to yours, beneath the fig tree. Juju says, no. He loves to listen. He says he knows what you're reading. Says he remembers it from high school, years ago, the very play. Says it's beautiful, the play, your voice, the way you read. You sound like Africa, says Juju. That's what they call you here, Africa. You've never told anyone your real name. That's for home, for your father's house, to which you will return. You read. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Brother, Juju says, I love you.
Wow. That was Jeff Charlotte, and you were listening to him reading from his newest book, This Brilliant Darkness, A Book of Strangers. Jeff's an associate professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth, and also the best-selling author of The Family, which has just been made into a Netflix documentary series, Sea Street and Sweet Heaven When I Die. His work has earned numerous awards, including the National Magazine Award and the Outspoken Award. That was an extremely powerful bit of reading, Jeff. even though it was on the radio. you had to suppress a couple of words there.
I did. I never write in the second person. That's, you know, when you address you. And I was especially wary of doing so with this story about an unarmed black man whose real name was Charlie Lundu Kunang, who was killed. He was held down by police officers, unarmed, held down, pinned to the sidewalk, and shot six times, killed by a contact shot straight through the heart. But as I spent time talking to his family, talking to his friends, for some reason that address seemed appropriate, and they felt it was appropriate too, just at a moment, to ask us to really try and feel Charlie's humanity.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
His beauty as well, I think.
Well, I love the second person. I find it very effective, in especially here. But how odd that you and I would get talking, and this book very much is about using Facebook and Facebook connections, and you and I talk a lot on Facebook, and found out about your book on there, that your publicist didn't send me this one. She sent me them before, but I found out about it on Facebook, and we got talking, and here you are on Right on Radio tonight, right after we've had a situation here where the city nearly burnt down. And it's quite ironic working on that particular issue in your book about a killing that happened in, 5 years ago. I suppose that must be sucking up all the air for this book at the moment, that issue.
I mean, I published this book in February. I worked on this book for many years. It's mm-hmm. Charlie's story is the heart of it, but it's a story of many people, including my own. Worked on it for many years, published it in February, and I was one of the lucky ones. I got a little bit of a book tour before the pandemic shut things down. And I have mostly, I've done, I'm so grateful to you, Ian, and to those who invite me on, but I think we're at a moment right now where conversation is so broad that most writers I know feel a little uncomfortable saying, hey, look at my new book at this moment.
That is right.
There's so much urgent news that we also must absorb. But I think we have to, at least I can speak for myself, I benefit from doing both, from reading the longer form work, the work that's been building for a long time, and following the news urgently and trying to understand the world around me.
Well, we've had the same feelings from several authors in the last few weeks, especially, feeling very perturbed about where they sit with all this. But let's just focus on the book. And it's a brilliant book. It's 116 pictures in it, which you've mostly, I think all of them are from your iPhone. Is that correct?
They are. So the book began years ago. I write a lot of magazine stories, and I was, I live in Vermont, a very small town area, so sometimes you like to work late at night. At the time, I had insomnia, couldn't work, so the only place to go late at night around where I live was a Dunkin' Donuts, and I'm sitting in the Dunkin' Donuts, and I notice the night baker is wearing this T-shirt with this very Baroque skull on it, which, if you've ever been to a Dunkin' Donuts, you can imagine a big skull is not the logo. And I get to talking to him. It's his last night of work. He's quitting the job. He hates the job. He hates the night shift. And we just get to talking, and it's those kind of candid conversations you sometimes have late at night. And he has a little tear tattooed beneath his eye. And I ask him what it's for, and it's for his son who died as an infant. And I asked if I could take his picture with my phone, just the same camera we have in our pocket. And he said yes. And I wrote a little story, and I posted it on Instagram, and I hashtagged it Night Shift. And then I hit the hashtag, who else is awake at night? Well, thousands and thousands of people. And that's where the book really began. And I started taking the photographs. I've always been very engaged with photography, but I didn't think of myself as a photographer. But I, like many journalists, always take pictures as notes. And suddenly those notes became the story itself. And so I move back and forth between image and text, sometimes telling the story with a sentence, sometimes with a picture.
And sometimes there's a picture and then, quite a long, short story length or article length piece as well, which is, it's broken up. It's almost like a miscellany, which is, I don't think we use that word very much anymore, but you know what I mean by that, right?
Yeah, I do. I love that. I hadn't thought of that. It is. It's a book of fragments, so it's I ended up, it sort of documents 2 years of my life, essentially, that began in my early 40s. My father, with whom I was very close, had had a heart attack in Vermont. He lived in upstate New York. I would drive back and forth across the mountains, and I was insomniac. I had a lot of things. I was having a hard time processing all the stories I'd collected as a writer over the years. And so I'd start talking to people and asking if I could take their picture and writing these short kind of prose poems a little bit that were made up of their language. They started assembling and taking on their own form. Some of them took serial form. So the essay Charlie Kunang is the heart of the book, and there's another sort of very long passage about a woman named Mary Mazur, an older woman, pretty severe mental health issues, who lived in what's called a transient or a welfare motel, and ended up telling her story over many pictures and many stories. And then thinking about, how do all these fit together? How does this become, in effect, sort of a memoir told through other people's lives, is how I began to think of it. And that gave it its organizing principle. As I wrote the last sentence of the book, or what I thought was the last sentence, when I was 44, and I pushed, literally, I mean, this was, I don't mean this in a sort of conflation of symmetry, I said, that's it, that's the last sentence. I pushed myself back from the table. It was 2 years after my father's heart attack, and I felt a pressure in my chest, and it was my heart attack. And no one wants a heart attack, but, I had to say, even by the time I was in the hospital, I didn't know if I was going to make it through the night, but I was joking with a friend. I'm like, well, if I make it, this book's going to have incredible symmetry.
It does. I mean, that's an amazing thing. I was going to ask you how you came up with the unity, you know, whatever it is that holds all this together. And on a kind of psychological level, it's the heart attacks, the heart attack of Dad and then the heart attack of you, and 2 years later. And I'm always aware of that, because that's laid out very early in the book. And and you know, I'm getting the sense of a kind of search, a kind of lost in the night. I kept sort of hearing a kind of Charles Bukowski, a kind of anthem, almost music, created from these collages. And it really caught my attention very early on. And I loved that about it, and took me back to, you know, Richard Brautigan, and was that Fly Fishing in America, and some Wisconsin Death Trip, and then some of those books about dead bodies, you know, when they put the narrative of the dead person into it.
Well, that's amazing that you say Wisconsin Death Trip. The author of that great book, Michael Lessie, was my teacher as an undergraduate and has been my close friend ever since. I very much understood this book as a death trip. Wisconsin Death Trip of Michael Lessie. We published originally in 1972.
That's right. Yeah.
A book of photographs that he found in an archive, and excerpts from newspapers and from the late 19th century. Photographs, the terrifying photographs, many of them. People, their children, if your baby died, what did you do? You called in the portrait photographer.
Yeah.
You had a photograph taken. And I learned so much from Michael, and this book very much was sort of my attempt, after years of writing a lot of books and a lot of journalism, of what was the purpose of that kind of storytelling that I was originally doing. You mentioned Bukowski too. You know, I'd never been a fan. I'd never read Bukowski. The first time I finished this book, I had a heart attack. The second time I finished this book was by my father's deathbed. He survived his heart attack, lived on for several years, died a year and a half ago of cancer, and I finished the book by his deathbed, and then was going through his things at his home, and he was not a Charles Bukowski kind of person. If anyone knows what Bukowski means, not like that. And there, though, was a heavily annotated, big collected volume of Bukowski's poems, and it was such a startling kind of moment to sort of, and as you say, I started reading them because he had read them, and after thinking for years, I don't like that guy, I had to recognize that there was a certain kind of affinity between what I was trying to do and telling these late night stories of these people who were as lost as I was, and by telling their stories, trying to find my way somewhere.
Well, I think your dad, in liking Bukowski, and you know, like probably a lot of us who live most of the time, at least, after we've matured a bit, live a cleaner sort of life than Charles Bukowski did. And I mean, a lot of very smart people and very conventional people love him because it gives one an entrance into that dark world that you're talking about. And I think your book does the same thing. It's this brilliant darkness, and it's very well titled in that sense. And you do take us down into the streets, and you take us to Africa, and you take us to Dublin, and you take us to Russia, and you have a gun pointed at you several times, and you're right in front of knives and all these kinds of things. It's very brave of you what you've done, and of course you're a journalist and you're willing to do that, but it does take us to places where great writing should. And then you also add a picture to it, which is this is a certain kind of genre, I think, that, you know, going back to you know, Wisconsin Death Trip and those kinds of day book collections, it's its own genre, really, isn't it?
It is, you know, I mean, there's the genre of the sort of a book of words and pictures, but then there's, of course, another kind of story that we tell with words and pictures, and this is actually another place for where this began for me. I told a lot of these stories originally on Instagram, and I always have to, whenever I talk about it, I say, like, I don't want to be a shill for Instagram. It's a big, bad corporation, et cetera, et cetera. But what it provided me was this way to sequentially tell stories with words and pictures. And as a writer, over the years, when I was a kid, I loved comic books, just, you know, superhero comic books. I still like graphic novels and graphic writing and so on. It's not as much a part of my life. But when I'm stuck as a writer, I go to the comic book store and I just buy a bunch of comic books. It almost doesn't matter what they are. I'm interested in the motion between words and pictures, the way the reader sets into motion the images together. So, you know, there's the white space that you see between panels in a comic book. Comic book artists call this the gutter, right? You know, in panel one, Wonder Woman is swinging her magic lasso, right? In panel two, she's got the bad guy all tied up. Your imagination provides some movement in between. So when I get stuck as a writer, I look at that and to help myself sort of restart. And I was stuck as a writer early on in this book, and I bought some comics and I was reading them. I had recently signed on to Instagram for the same reason most people do, friends and family. But I was looking at those squares and the space for the writing underneath, and I said, oh, look, I can't draw, but it's like I could make a comic book of my own. I could tell a story with words and pictures. And that was really essential. You know, all these books that you mentioned, Wisconsin Death Trip, the idea of a miscellany, the idea of a fragmented narrative, I think people come to that when they have a feeling that, for them at least, the traditional ways of telling a story are no longer working. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly where I was. I was tired of writing magazine stories. I was tired of working the formula. I need to break the story down and find my own way into it.
Well, it certainly works, and, you know, I found it very satisfying. I mean, I love to read a well-formed novel or, you know, a really good piece of memoir, you know, that's literary-based and the rest of it. But I also loved, you know, just the freedom of jumping through these very short pieces and being able to attach a real face to, you know, a young man who later on overdoses, or a Cossack that with his weapons all around him, who doesn't like gay people, you know, or somebody who doesn't like a Jew, and you have to tell them you're a Jew. And I loved being in those short little explosive moments with you, knowing that you actually did it and took
It was important to me, too, because it gives these people a way to occupy some space in the story. I hate that phrase that you sometimes hear, you know, oh, I give a voice for the voiceless. No such thing. You're just someone with a book contract, right? These people have voices and tell their own stories. And I tell my story about them, but by including the photograph, and these are photographs I'd asked to take with their permission, they are portraits sort of in the style of a photographer that I really love, Milton Rogovin, and I don't mean to compare myself to him as one of the great 20th century photographers, but who really said, you know, where the portrait wouldn't really be so much candid, it would just sort of say, how would you like me to photograph you? So that Cossack, the Cossack who pointed a gun at me and forced me to write down his horrible sort of homophobic violence, nonetheless, he sort of stood there, said, you know, get me in my uniform with my whip and my knife and my gun. It allows a sort of the subject, and when the subject is not the Cossack, but someone like the other person you mentioned there, Jared Miller, a young man I met on Skid Row while learning about Charlie Kunang's life, and ended up making a series of portraits of him and his story, and about the son that he hoped to overcome his addiction so that he could return to. And the strangest thing, I posted these on Instagram, and all the women in his life, ex-girlfriend, ex-wife, mother-in-law, and ultimately his mother, found each other in the comments of this Instagram post, and they were all arguing about who had the best plan for rescuing Jared, and I ended up becoming acquainted with his mother, and she sort of shared with me the story and the ups and downs, and the story doesn't end well. Jared died. Mm. Not everyone makes it through this book.
No, they don't.
But it seemed very important to me that Jared gets to look at the camera, gets to compose himself as he would like to be seen. And while I write the sentences, and yes, I frame the photograph, nonetheless, he is his own self. And I love that conversation back and forth. This, you know, the book is, there's a phrase from another writer, a friend of mine named Leslie Jameson, a recent book of hers called The Recovering. And she's writing about 12-step groups, Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. She is an alcoholic and, you know, owes a great deal to those communities. And she has a great phrase. She says, the saving alchemy of community. I love that phrase, the saving alchemy. Alchemy, it's a magic. It's a transformation of base materials into gold and of community. And this is what everybody in this book, even the scary characters, all end up becoming part of this community. And which, to a certain extent, we try and save ourselves and save each other by telling stories together for a while.
You are listening to Right On Radio at KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Sean Carroll, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right On Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and so on.